January 1952, there was an incident over an American airbase in Alaska. The airbase radar operators see an object appear at 23,000 feet. It's traveling 1,500 miles per hour. They scramble some jets, F-94 fighter planes, that go after this thing. The first plane gets pretty close to it, and this object that's traveling at 1,500 miles per hour suddenly reverses course, goes right at the F-94 fighter, and stops. Basically stops. I mean, these maneuvers back then were impossible. As Colin Bennett says, they were something in the realms of science fiction, and they remain there a half a century later. The decision of the Air Force as a way to explain this must have been freak weather. Even though three different pilots saw it, the ground radar picked it up. It was there's no question it was a solid object, but that's how they explained it away. And of course, in the 50 years since then, we all understand that that is how our military has treated some of the most dramatic UFO cases. We'll get into some other dramatic cases that were investigated by the first UFO hero, Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, head of Project Blue Book. He is featured in Colin Bennett's new book, Flying Saucers Over the White House. More from Colin Bennett right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Colin Bennett, let's talk about a couple of the cases that you discuss in the book, things that popped up, incidents, encounters that were investigated by the Air Force, both before and during and after Ruppelt was there. The one at Fort Monmouth in New Jersey. Tell me what happened there and how the Air Force responded. Colin? We're waiting to see if we can get Colin Bennett back. He's the author of this new book, Flying Saucers Over the White House, The Inside Story of Captain Edward J. Ruppelt and His Official U.S. Air Force Investigation of UFOs. As I had mentioned, that it's the most fascinating period in ufology for me. It's what got me sort of hooked on the topic because it was a time when the Air Force was still willing to investigate some of these cases honestly. Before sort of the secrecy apparatus was put into effect. Colin Bennett is back with us. Colin, tell me about the incident at Fort Monmouth in New Jersey, how the Air Force responded to this or failed to respond.
Well, Monmouth in New Jersey, yeah. The pilots reported what was to become the usual characteristics. High speed of solid objects were observed, complex maneuvers in the Mach 1 region, which would have broken the physical structures of the time apart. Materials technology hadn't reached the stage where aircraft were made of structures which could take Mach 1 and, believe it or not, well above Mach 1, which is ridiculous. It was way beyond Earth technology. And this was being observed by, again, experienced flyers who were very angry at their reports being either ignored, turned down, destroyed, yeah, or generally trashed. They began a resentment against higher authority, and that's the psychosocial factor that entered the UFO game. The Fort Monmouth and the New Jersey experiences by pilots were largely ignored, in answer to your question, even though there were expert reports.
The incident in Alaska, I just mentioned it during the tease. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? I mean, here we've got this base. It's not like there's other air traffic up there. This is not a route for jetliners or something.
No.
Something very unusual appeared in the skies up there.
Yes. I just forget the names of the people concerned.
That's
You have to look at for a little while at the Alaskan situation at that time. The reason why in 52 there were no jets guarding Washington for a short while is because of Curtis LeMay policy of assuming, putting all his fighters in the northern envelope, and so the Alaskan front was a place of considerable intellectual concentration as regards American fighter defense, and again it concerned the Sabre. Again, this is what Rupert observed first of all: the same kind of discs, the same kind of maneuvers, and the inability of Sabre pilots and F-94 pilots to give chase. They did give chase indeed, but the objects, mainly discs, sometimes blurs, shot ahead of them. It ignored all kinds of macro region or limitations. They didn't appear to have limitations, particularly in Alaska, of speed, range, maneuver. No limitations were observed by people who knew what maneuvers, sky maneuvers, were about.
This Alaska thing, you would detail some of what happened, that three different F-94s were scrambled chasing this thing. And at one point, at least the third fighter and its two-man crew came within 200 yards of the UFO that was just sort of hovering up there.
Yes, okay. They observed a solid disc. But again, this was... didn't come to anything. It's an observation. I mean, all you can say to your controllers as a fighter pilot is eyeball contact with a solid disc. I mean, do you want him to grab you by the throat and say it again? You just have to get through. They're not going to have it.
Well,
so, they're not going to have it. You fighter pilots on exercise must remember that the Alaskan region. Fighter pilots were fully, fighter aircraft were fully armed, ready for Russian confrontation. And, you know, the very best combat pilots were in that region, put there by LeMay, and they wouldn't open fire unless they caused a third, you know, they might have caused a Third World War, because they were not on training flights. They were on active alert in the Alaskan region, according to LeMay's idea that the Russian bombers, they didn't exist, by the way, were going to come that way. And therefore, you have a state of extreme alertness of armed fighter pilots. And so their alertness, their vision, their experience was of the best in the Air Force. And if they got down or radioed to you that they saw a solid disc, here again is the question. Momentarily, LeMay and his staff might have said, well, this is a Russian secret weapon. But they didn't even say that. they ignored it. I mean, it might well have been, at a pinch, a Russian secret weapon, which you think, oh, yeah, well, they're going to investigate this disc sighting in terms of Russian weaponry. That would have been allowed. That would have been legitimate. They didn't even do that. They didn't even consider the suggestion, although it was made very briefly. But the performance of the disc was frightening. and it was dismissed all idea of this being a Russian weapon.
Write in your book, the decision of ATIC on this event, it was due to freak weather. Captain
freak
James,
weather.
Chief of the radar section of ATIC, persuaded Ruppelt at the time that this was the explanation.
Yes.
That's insulting to those pilots.
Yeah, insulting to the pilots. And if you're insulting to professional people like this, they begin to resent the sending in the reports anyway. Like the General Mills balloon people. They were.
Yeah, tell about that. Tell about those guys.
Oh, well, it's rather an old-fashioned technology now. But in those days, atmospheric balloons were the fashion for high-altitude research. These balloons contained what in those days was called a gondola, which was a space for equipment and for observers with oxygen supplied. And you sat there in this gondola, which was rather like the gondolas strung underneath the old Zeppelin craft. And you drank your coffee and you observed the instrumentation and you recorded the instrumentation on pen recorders and certainly wire, some wire recording. And the it was initially a very good idea for weather reporting because they had high-powered radios aboard and they would radio weather to ships and aircraft all over the world. And it was a wholly successful endeavor. And they sat up there, and then when Ruppelt asked these people about UFOs, they said, oh, we see UFOs all the time. But we first reported them because we have the instrumentation better than any fighter aircraft to record the characteristics. We did this. Two things happened. We heard back from headquarters about weather, about icing, about temperature levels. We never heard back about a UFO observation. And these people were expert observers of sky, weather.
Yeah, that's their job. That was their job.
Hear back. So they said, oh, well, they're obviously rejecting all UFO reports. We see scores of them. Scores of UFOs, but we're getting a bit fed up with the headquarters not replying, not responding. No, they were only interested. Someone cracked the board, one of the gondolas. They're only interested in non-human artifacts, such as ice, wind, and temperature.
Right, right. And, now these guys saw so many. I mean, they saw so many that they.
Rupert was told by the mill people.
They saw so many, they stopped taking reports, not only because the headquarters didn't respond, but also because it became so common. At least that's what you write.
Yeah, they were seeing lots of things which they didn't bother reporting. Again, I repeat, their equipment was far better than the fighter pilot's equipment in terms of the weather technology at the time. And these were three or four expert observers. As distinct from a single pilot.
You said and that so, this is the Aeronautical Division of General Mills that were involved with this balloon program.
Yes.
Were they working with the government then, or?
On contract.
I see.
Yeah, it was a private firm. I don't think it exists now. They were working on contract. It became rather an old-fashioned technology due to satellites. You know, satellites. Were apparently, I don't know much about weather observation, were apparently a lot better in getting the same information for less money. You know.
So all these cases are coming in. Ruppelt is trying to get his team up and running. At the same time that he's trying to do legitimate investigations, he's doing a lot of briefings. Scientists who are coming to ATIC, briefings for people in the Pentagon. Talk about that for a couple of minutes.
Yes, of course. Oh, yeah. He established a liaison. Between the scientific establishment, which in those days, it appears it was far more independently minded. Now, it's in the hands of the corporations. Science is the corporate culture. And after the 60s, it began to close its doors, I'm afraid. And this is a criticism of science. So what? It began to close its doors. It became involved with heavy corporate maneuvers and politics of one sort or another. The old-fashioned pre-60 lab contained people of independent minds, such as Hynek, Professor Hynek, who first was skeptic and later turned into a UFO believer. He wrote Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Spielberg made a film of that name. Hynek was a convert, and he was a reputable scientist of great reputation, and still is, God bless him, even though he's dead long ago. And people like him, people like Hynek, people indeed in those days, rather like Stanton Friedman, who's another scientist, began to investigate UFO beliefs. There are not many of them left. Of Hynek or Stanton Friedman's reputation. Very few. Oh, yeah. Bruce McAbee, who is a great UFO investigator. He's another scientist, believe it.
Jacques Vallée as well?
Yeah.
Jacques Vallée as well? Yeah, Bruce McAbee?
Yes.
But you note in the book that, and I'm quoting here, every one of the scientists and engineers who reviewed the UFO material at ATIC made a strong point. We should give strong priority to getting reasonably accurate measurements of the speed, altitude, and size of reported UFOs, which, of course, is what scientists should be doing, the kind of questions they should ask. And you also make the point that Ruppelt is giving briefings to military people, folks at the Pentagon, and that it's like standing room only. These are very popular briefings.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking about an era in time when, unbelievably, intellectual democracy reigned far more than it does now, due to corporatism, is my opinion anyway. Scientists could join, a university science department, and if they were careful, they could talk about UFOs, they could talk about the paranormal, no one minded. You try that today in a corporate laboratory, you'll be sacked. You would be, or some other means could be found to dispose of you. Science has got, if you want to use a metaphor, you know, stiffening limbs of somewhat corporate old age. It's not youthful anymore. Science was youthful. And you know, you got Ruppelt, who was a relatively young man, and it was a youthful enterprise. You're really going to read Chuck Yeager's book, yeah? And you'll realize the marvelous atmosphere at this time. We were going to the moon sooner or later. Yeager was flying the Bell X-1. And Tom Wolfe's novel, The Right Stuff, and film, indeed, with Sam Shepard, was an expression of this intellectual excitement of the time, which possessed Ruppelt and many other people. That atmosphere, I'm afraid, of young, innocent, striving America, I'm afraid has clouded. This is not a criticism of America. I'm married to a wonderful American woman. It's sitting opposite me. And that's what I would say. There is this marvelous psychosocial element to ufology and indeed its ancillary technology that's gone from this period.
Well, it's as if a curtain has dropped over a spirit of free inquiry on that and perhaps other topics as well.
Yeah, sure. I might write a book on this aspect. I've got some notes on it, and I don't want to get too philosophical. But culture, the American Air Force, let's just stick to the American Air Force, is a scientific organization and a military organization. And above all, it is a culture. And cultures are known to develop antidotes to enemies. And it's almost as if, at the same time as belief is created, a kind of culture of what I call denial is created as a kind of psychosocial balance within organizations. And it affects, it divides people. I don't think the Air Force, in cultural terms, can live with fantastic elements. They're not, generally speaking, this is what Ruppelt came against, the fantastic element caused alienation, caused hackles to rise, you know, because you don't go to, God bless the American Air Force, but you don't go, excuse me, you don't go to the Air Force for intellectuals. Air Force is not about intellectuals.
I understand. It's about defense. Yes. We're going to need to take a break. I'm sorry to interrupt, Colin. We'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about the incident that sort of lifted the veil from over Edward Ruppelt's eyes, the Washington UFO overflights that were so dramatic back then. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're talking with Colin Bennett, who's written this fascinating new biography of Captain Edward Ruppelt, the first head of Project Blue Book. And Colin writes, among other things, in a web age, conspiracy research is one of the very few ways of obtaining information in any meaningful sense. the official reality, that's capitalized, the official reality 50 years later is looked upon universally as a corrupt entity. Ruppelt is interesting because he's half in, half out of this sea change in human affairs, and will tell you what incident led him to be sort of half in and half out and sort of destroyed his illusions of the legitimacy of the Blue Book study right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, the scene is Captain Edward J. Ruppelt is put in charge of what becomes Project Blue Book. He's got a staff. He's got it organized. They're getting cases that are really interesting. They're doing investigations. He's briefing scientists. He's briefing other military officials. He thinks he's got something really good going here. And all things seem to be pointing to that he's actually going to be able to investigate UFOs. He even had exchanges with the RAF that's mentioned in Colin Bennett's book. The RAF had had enough UFO cases that they officially recognized the UFO as a legitimate a subject for inquiry. And so things are going Ruppelt's way. That's a really interesting time, Colin. You got to be thinking what's going through his head is that Ruppelt has to believe, hey, I'm really being allowed to do this. I might be able to solve this mystery.
Yes. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Yes, that's what he thought. The things are going well. But he gets, in his own book, we must realize that it's my book, a biography of Ruppelt, but he did indeed write his own book called Investigation into Flying, into Unidentified Flying Objects.
And we'll get into that.
He wrote when he left the Air Force.
Right.
In his book, he gets, I did note this, of course, because I'm writing I wrote a biography, in that he's becoming increasingly bitter. He's still a serving officer. He's under the Secrets Act. So he can't open his mouth too wide. Project Blue Book was a secret project, and it's bottling him up. They're trying to shut him down all the time. The sources of information are often very good. Then suddenly, out, rather like a light being switched out. They've been got at. The people who were willing scientists, pilots, other kind of people belonging to other any kind of discipline that you care to think about, are being steadily shut down as far as contacts are concerned. Evidence is being mysteriously lost or destroyed by high-ranking people. There is indeed a conspiracy against Project Blue Book, and Ruppelt detects this. He's still a young man. He's still got hopes that his project on UFOs within the Air Force would expand and succeed in the face of evidence, which is coming in almost every hour to Project Blue Book, of UFO sightings, incredible maneuvers, disks. The UFO is forming its classic shape, yet his research is restricted and his requests for information are drying up.
So who's behind that? Who imposed that? What structure was used to spread the word, hey, don't cooperate with Project Blue Book or Edward Ruppelt?
Yeah, well, let's just look at two extremes. First extreme is the paranoid military, who cannot stand anything which is of a certain degree of fantasy or imagination. To give them their due, the pessimists and skeptics, and within the Air Force we're talking about, are not trained for this kind of what they would call in those days hippie investigation. They're military police. They're military people. In a sense, that they have minds like policemen. And they're not. It's the science fiction element in reality which disturbs them deeply and turns on an automatic skepticism within them. They're not going to take this level of speculation.
And it goes beyond just skepticism, though. It's refusal to acknowledge facts that stare them right in the face.
Oh, yeah. Well, they wouldn't call... They go so far as not calling them facts, you know. to the most experienced fighter pilot, they will question him like the Gestapo until he becomes scared. You know, no, I didn't see anything. You know, they're trying to make him erase what he saw. He's just very, very sinister, for goodness sake. You know, and it reached a peak by 1968 where the Air Force decided that even the negative side, even the pessimistic side, wouldn't do. They shut down the UFO altogether.
Let's talk about the incident that sort of brought it all home, pulled the veil away from Edward Ruppelt's eyes, and that's the Washington overflights. Happened on two different weekends, July 1952. This is a really incredibly, this is a dramatic series of events here.
Yeah. Well, let me describe this. According to the logbook, first of all, Washington had then in 52, as it has now, three main airfields. The first one is Washington National Airport, civilian. The other two are Air Force bases, Bolling Air Force Base and Andrews Air Force Base. Andrews Air Force Base housed a fighter squadron of F-94s, which were the fighter defense of course, the capital of American culture. And so these three bases were only a few miles apart, and they were managed by very powerful radar systems and sets and communications. According to the logbook of the Civil Airline Association, at 11:40 on the night of July the 19th, two radars picked up seven unidentified targets east and south of Andrews Air Force Base. Edward Nugent, the air traffic controller, saw that the targets were 50 miles away and in a prohibited area. Of course, it's a prohibited area. It's the capital of America, for goodness sake. But as we see from 9/11, the prohibited area is largely meaningless in certain circumstances. A white 747 was seen. For instance, it should never be explained above the White House, etc. Well, back to 1952. Okay. Now, the first thing to me, these glowing orbs. First thing about these glowing orbs, which are approaching, the National Airport, was that there were glowing blobs. Yeah, you couldn't make out anything distinct about them, but they weren't supposed to be there. And one of them, there were also their slow speed was unusual. Too slow for any jets, and even the propeller-driven airliners, like the Constellation in those days, too slow. And then some of them, of the group, stopped in midair. All this information is coming from direct observation from the control tower and from the actual big control room. Edward G. Barnes was the controller for this evening, and he saw the manifestations, blobs, call them what you were, registered on the screen. Now, here's where the mystery deepens. He decides that the situation is such that he must call for interceptors from Andrews Air Force Base. He's not been told that Andrews Air Force Base runways are all dug up and there's not a single F-94 available. Great, yeah. And Bolling was mainly an administrative area, which in those days, which didn't contain a single fighter. Well, there's Barnes in the control room of the biggest airport in Washington, and he realizes that the president and three-quarters of the American government don't have any fighter defense. He gets a bit scared and gets on to Newcastle Air Force Base, 100 miles away. Scramble fighters to Washington immediately. Now, here's perhaps a pattern of those days. Here we have a civilian ordering warplanes to come to Washington. Hmm. I mean, yeah. This is truly astonishing that a civilian could order such a thing as armed warplanes. an Axis, moreover, Axis fighter controller, for which he wasn't trained. Apparently, the military, particularly the intelligence side of the Pentagon, were not available. They were all asleep. They didn't see anything. How about that?
So, yes, and so these guys...
Am I allowed to say it?
Yes, we're okay. So that this air traffic controller is not the only one who's seeing this stuff, though. There's others that are seeing it as well, right?
Yeah. Okay. So there's the after a considerable delay, a single F-94 is sent from Newcastle. When he gets there, he's low on fuel and he can't see anything. So he returns to base. You begin to realize when you read all these reports that there was no tactical brain here covering the entire situation. We've got two Air Force bases, which are absolutely useless. They've seen the objects, but they don't have any fighters available. How about that? And so Barnes is at a loss. I don't know what it is in the American chain of command that allows a civilian, an untrained man, to summon armed fighters from a distant base and get them in the air and give them instructions. The pilots are asking, they're surprised that Edward Barnes, a civilian, is vectoring them. I don't know under what military constitution a civilian can order fighters and vector them into different areas. But Barnes did. He did it effectively in the lack of a military alternative. The military were not present in any of these events. They didn't see them. They weren't present. The intelligence section of the Pentagon, they were all asleep. They're not concerned. As if, you know, nothing's happened at all. It so happened that, people, honeymoon couples in the parks, in the Washington parks, were seeing the things. You know, if babes in prams had been present, they could have seen the things. Cats and dogs could have seen the things. They were high in the sky over Washington doing various incredible maneuvers, one of which was recorded by the National Airport Control Tower at suddenly going from a stationary position into 7,000 mile an hour turn, registered by on the radar, like that, and the radar. The radar graticule registered a speed of 7,000 miles an hour. How about that?
And as we were to learn later, the official explanation, General Samford and some others explained these things away, including the similar sightings the following weekend. They're temperature inversions, right?
Yeah. Temperature inversions, yeah. That was after the second weekend. The UFOs returned a fortnight later. Of course, after the first weekend, all hell broke loose. As far as the civilian population were concerned, there were every Washington newspaper after the 20th of July contained, you know, two inch high headlines. What are these things? And we demand an explanation. Everybody in Washington bought the newspapers. From the Pentagon, silence. That's the first weekend. No comment about that. This is what you pay taxes for, American public who are listening here. This is total silence. Everybody was asleep. The president was in his bed, and presumably so was the Pentagon Air Intelligence Arm. And yet cats and dogs could have seen it in the street. Nobody's looking up in the military, apparently. And it's no use phoning Vandenberg because he doesn't think UFOs exist anyway. and so there was this terrific row on the radio, on the TV.
Of course, Ruppelt thinks that he considers himself the Air Force's UFO guy. In fact, he coined the phrase UFO. He's going to go to Washington, but he finds out that he's not the Air Force's UFO guy, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It so happened, by one of those marvelous 14 coincidences, that on this night of July the 19th, Ruppelt was in Washington on a Pentagon mission. He was going to write, several articles for the Pentagon on UFOs. Or sympathetic people in the Pentagon on UFOs. And if he had looked out of his window, he could have seen them.
Huh.
Amazing. Okay, this terrific row. The media are interested. Radio, television, newspapers, yeah? No single element of the Pentagon, intelligence, Air Force, whatever, makes a comment. They did have a press officer, Bob Gino. No. Al Chop was the press officer. And he was going crazy trying to get the statement out of the Air Force. The Air Force were tearing their hair because the Air Force, as I mentioned before, was then a corporate bureaucracy. And if you're a lieutenant or a captain in a corporate bureaucracy in the Pentagon, you don't suddenly dash to the streets and start telling people things. Their mouths were the Pentagon mouth was closed completely. And of course, the public began to get annoyed with this. What are we paying taxes for if unknown maneuvering lights are right over the Capitol? We could have been wiped out overnight, and they were dead right. If these maneuvering lights had been, just let's stretch our imagination for a moment, it would have been God help America, because not one of them would have been shot down. So the public was beginning to raise disturbing questions about American air security. Where was the Pentagon? Where were the fighters? Et cetera. Extraordinary questions. Andrews Air Force Base, the runways were being dug up, but they did have a fighter squadron in full condition there. Couldn't the fighter squadron, or at least two flights, have been flown to the National Airport, which is only a few miles away, and therefore had full tanks to go up there for some time? Another question is, why didn't they go to Boeing? In other words, there were no fighters within 100 miles. They had to go. Barnes himself had to go to a Sleepy Hollow a fighter base 100 miles away. It was Newcastle fighter base, who took hours to send a single F-94. Who saw nothing. Yeah. Sleepy Hollow's name, I think. Sleepy Hollow. There is Barnes directing an F-94. In a reflection of 9/11, it's rather like a civilian, untrained man, Dick Cheney, flinging F-16s around the sky as if there was no tomorrow. Was Dick Cheney a fighter insect expert, a military man? No. So it seems that to UK eyes, I mean, we're a much smaller nation, but to UK eyes, it sounds fantastic that civilians such as Dick Cheney in 9/11 and Howard Barnes in 52 could direct fighter planes. UK minds can't understand that. And anyway, it happens. And there's hell let loose. Rupert is dragged from his bed to the foyer of one of the Pentagon complexes, and there's the press. It can't speak, of course, because Project Blue Book was a secret project. But they got out, they ferreted out that he's the UFO man, and he has to get out of the way.
He has to get out of the way for higher-ranking officers who suddenly become they become the voice of the Air Force on the subject of UFOs, and seemingly know very little about it. And this sort of is the beginning, or at least the most dramatic indication of a cover-up to come. We'll continue our conversation with Colin Bennett right after this on Coast to Coast AM.